You've got mail. Some of you are lost right now. Don't worry, this is the overlap. This is the episode you downloaded. But it's others of you may have had a Pavlovian response to those three magic words that inspired a blockbuster rom-com with A-listers Tom Hanks and Meg Ryan. But I digress. Before you could hear those magic words, you've got mail, when you signed up for the America Online service, you first had to listen to this horrific train wreck of a noise that many of us know is the modem, your modem connecting to the internet service. But if you heard that for the first time without context, or without the context of modems and signing up and logging onto the internet, you could be forgiven for thinking that that's the sound of the emergency broadcast system attesting the emergency broadcast system, or you might wait for an announcement to say, take shelter. Those are the little things that happen when there's a generational divide, or when technologies come and go, and new technologies come at a faster and faster rate, and you have to try to figure out how to get a handle on them. You're stuck with only the tools that you have available to you, only the conceptual toolkit that you've been given by your experiences so far. And the fact that we operate from sometimes completely different conceptual toolkits with very little overlap, if any, makes it sometimes harder to communicate with those from earlier generations or even later generations. So my hope today is that you'll understand a little better at the end of this show why your parents use the internet the way they do and why your kids keep swiping on your big screen TV. So without further ado, let's get into the overlap. Perhaps more jarring than my starting off the podcast with you've got mail is the fact that I'm starting off the podcast at all. Many of you are used to hearing the dulcet tones of one Joshua, my co-host, starting this episode of the show. And already you can tell it's going to be a bit of a train wreck without him. But he is in parts unknown today, although it's rumored that he's teaching boomers how to close down browser tabs. But we'll see. Hopefully we'll be back next week to tell us about his adventures. So, as I mentioned before, you know, the cultural experiences or the experiences we have and the encounters we have with technologies tend to dictate how we develop our conceptual ability to grasp and understand and utilize new technologies. But that differs. And the easiest way to break this down, look, there are various ways to talk about when technologies were introduced, and we could divide up the world in all sorts of different ways, but the generational divide is the easiest way to go. So we're going to talk about from baby boomers to Gen Alpha or whatever the current kids are calling themselves these days, and talk about how their formative experiences in their context and their time in history impacted their ability to utilize and understand new technology. The fact is, every single one of us understands new things by comparing them to old things. At our core, our brain is a pattern-matching machine. When you encounter something unfamiliar, your brain asks, all right, what is this most like? What do I already know that kind of resembles this? I mean, that's what we're doing, right? When our distant ancestors would see, you know, would hear something moving through the underbrush, and wonder, okay, is it a saber-tooth, or not saber-tooth tiger, anachronism for the episode. Was it a tiger? Was it a lion? You know, was it a squirrel, a big squirrel? Or was it, you know, my friend coming back with dinner? We didn't know, right? When you experience a new experience or something's different about an experience for the first time, you have to compare it to an old experience, and you have to be able to do so quickly. And, you know, it's more important that you compare it to something and react to the way that keeps you from getting eaten, because that's how you pass along your genes. Psychologists call this idea schema theory. Your brain builds mental structures or schemas out of accumulated experience. And when something new arrives, you automatically slot it into the nearest available schema. It's fast, it's efficient, and most of the time it works remarkably well. I'm going to call this schema theory or these schemas your conceptual toolbox. And hopefully you'll see why as the episode progresses. Your toolbox is built from the time and place and technology you grew up around. It's shaped by your first encounters with communication, with media, with information itself. It's the sum of every mental model you developed before you even knew you were developing mental models. When a new technology shows up, you reach into your toolbox, and sometimes the toolbox fits the tool fits nearly perfectly. Smooth adaptation, right? No worries. Other times, not so much. And this is actually where it gets interesting. Partial fits or poor fits. What happens? What's going on there? Well, your previous concept might resemble the right tool, might look quite right when you look at it from one angle, might have a similar handle, but the head is wrong. Or you start making assumptions. Effectively, you make assumptions and you fill in the gaps with your old framework, and you end up wildly off course without even realizing it. Here's one of my favorite quick examples. When email first became widespread, people who came from a postal mail background treated it exactly like a letter. Dear so-and-so at the top. Sincerely, your full name at the bottom. 3 days before they'd reply, because that's how long it took you, how long you respectfully wait to respond to correspondence. And that's an odd thing to think about, that you actually took time when someone texted you, when someone sent you a letter back in the olden days, you would wait several days before even responding, which showed that you were giving what they said weight and giving it time, letting it settle in, making sure you fully understood it, that you didn't just rush off a quick reply. Now compare that to the other side of the generation. So, you know, or compare that to younger generations. People who grew up in chat culture and bulletin boards treated email like a conversation. It's just a little bit of an aside or maybe slightly more formal, but you can send an email with two sentences, no greeting, reply in 30 seconds, and nobody took offense to that from those generations. Meanwhile, people who, same technology, two completely different toolboxes. And the friction between those two users is not stubbornness or ignorance, it's a toolbox mismatch. Right? And that mismatch is everywhere. It's in our workplaces. It's in our families. It's in every interaction between people who grew up in different technological eras. So let's go generation by generation. Let's start with the namesake of this episode. Well, not really, but the baby boomers, right? Born roughly 1946 to 1964. Now, what's interesting about this, one thing I found interesting is I started thinking about this when I was thinking about technologies and how, people deal with technologies. MacGyver was one of my early heroes as a kid. And when I say MacGyver, I'm talking about Richard Dean Anderson. For those of you who are familiar with some other version of MacGyver, I don't really have anything to say to that. But MacGyver was, at least in the lore of the show, right? Regardless of Richard Dean Anderson's birthday, MacGyver was born in 1952, which puts him squarely in the boomer generation. Now, he was definitely working in the physical world, right? MacGyver used physical objects like chewing gum, tin foil, and a Swiss Army knife to defuse a nuclear bomb or whatever it was he was doing in a given week. Paperclip, rubber band, and a piece of aluminum foil, and he could build a helicopter out of a lawnmower and some bubble gum. But every item he had, you could see and hold the functions were seen in the real world. If you grew up in the boomer era, information itself was a physical thing. It had weight. It had a location, a specific, stable, and findable location. If you wanted to know about the history of the Roman Empire, you didn't go search Google. You walked to a shelf in a library, or maybe your home if you were lucky enough to have an Encyclopedia Britannica, pull out volume R, and hope your brother hadn't spilled Hawaiian punch on page 402. If you needed a plumber, you opened the Yellow Pages. An actual book the size of a paving stone, and looked under P. You picked the guy with the biggest ad or the reassuring name AAA Plumbers, who clearly understood the importance of alphabetical advantage. Communication worked the same way. You wrote a letter. by hand. You paid long distance rates to call someone in another state using a physical phone that may was probably wired to your wall and possibly using rotary dial tone or rotary dialing for it. You paid long distance rates to call someone in another state. Back in those days, it mattered how far someone was from you as to what they paid to call them, which is kind of bizarre to think about, but I guess it made sense to the early phone companies. Then the internet arrives, right? And from a boomer's perspective, their brain makes a completely logical leap. Okay, the internet is basically like a big library, or maybe a very efficient filing cabinet, or a phone with a keyboard. That's the toolbox talking. And you know what? It's not totally wrong. The internet does contain enormous amounts of organized information. The analogy has some merit, but the framework misses something crucial. The internet is also a broadcast medium. It's also a social space. It's a marketplace. It's an entertainment platform. It's all of these things simultaneously, and none of them map cleanly onto the idea of a library. So when social media shows up and suddenly the library is talking back at you, posting opinions, starting arguments, showing you targeted advertisements for things you only discussed out loud, boomers are completely thrown because libraries don't talk back. When the cloud arrived, it was genuinely disorienting. To someone whose toolbox says important things live in specific, stable, physical places, putting your files in the cloud feels like being told your car is parked somewhere in the atmosphere. It creates real anxiety, not because the person is unsophisticated, but because their toolbox is built for things you can touch, things with addresses, things you can lock up at night. It's funny, just the idea of a toolbox itself, right? It's for some generations, when they think of a toolbox, they may think of an actual something you carry with a handle on it, or something that's a big cart in your garage. Others are thinking of the sidebar on an app, their favorite app, that allows you to go through and make adjustments to things. Or in a Word document, your allows you to bold or underline text. So even the idea of a toolbox differs from generation to generation. People like my grandmother would when they first got a smartphone, would accidentally keep calling people by putting the phone in their pocket, right? And she thought the phone was broken. The phone was fine. Her pants were too small. She didn't understand why apps had to update in the middle of the night. A toaster, she told me, has never called me at 2 a.m. to say it was improving itself, which honestly, fair point. But here's what I want you to notice. The boomer approach to the internet as a powerful tool for accomplishing specific tasks isn't naive. It's actually a pretty good model for lots of uses. The gap is that the internet doesn't stay a tool. It becomes an environment, a place you exist in, not just use. The internet is less of a toolbox and more like a city. You don't use a city, you inhabit it. You move through it. It changes you as much as you change it. And boomers, brilliant and resourceful as they are, were handed a city and told it was a really good hammer. All right, let's turn to Gen X. Roughly born 1965 to 1980, although there's some dispute among those of us who were minted around the turn of Gen X to the millennials. We'll talk about that more later. This is the forgotten middle child of generational analysis. We don't talk about them enough, and honestly, that's kind of on brand for Gen X. They're used to it. They're called the Oregon Trail Generation, and I think that's the most perfect label in the history of generational labels, because the Oregon Trail, the game, the actual experience, was all about navigating between worlds, between the old and the new, and frequently dying of dysentery just when you thought you'd had it figured out. Here's what's in the Gen X toolbox. They grew up analog, but they were young enough and flexible enough to genuinely adopt digital. They didn't just learn to use computers, they understood them. Many of them built them. Many of them learned to code in BASIC on Commodore 64. They remember when saving your work actually meant pressing save right now with urgency, because if the power even blinked, your 3 hours of work could be gone. Poof. Digital ghost. That experience gave them something really valuable, an intimate relationship with machines. They understood that the computer was a system with rules, a logic you could learn, and they knew how to coax that logic. The remote control is actually one of my favorite Gen X mental model primers. Think about it. The TV remote functionally changed the relationship between people and media. Suddenly you could browse. You could jump between channels. You had nonlinear navigation through content. That is basically the conceptual DNA of hyperlinks. A Gen Xer who grew up channel surfing already had a reasonable schema for clicking around. early Facebook, early Craigslist, early web forums. To a Gen Xer, those felt intuitive because they mapped onto something familiar. Oh, this is like the cork board of the grocery store. It's like the classified ads. I get this. But here's where Gen X Toolbox creates fiction. Because they grew up debugging, they sometimes resist technology when it becomes invisible. When the interface disappears and you just tap a thing and it works, Gen Xers start to get suspicious. I know Gen Xers who don't fully trust software. They can't partially see under the hood. And honestly, those are excellent questions for people who once lost 3 weeks of work to a corrupted floppy disk. The Gen X Toolbox has something genuinely valuable in it. Skepticism earned through experience. The ability to think structurally, to ask, but what is actually happening underneath this? In a world increasingly full of black box technology, the instinct isn't paranoia, it's wisdom. The flip side is that Gen X can sometimes over-engineer their mental models for systems that are designed to be simple. They want to understand the bones of it, which is great, but sometimes the bones are intentionally buried so they don't have to think about them. That tension between wanting to understand the system and the system not wanting you to understand it anymore, that's the Gen X struggle. All right, millennials, born roughly 1981 to 1996. These are allegedly my people. We millennials, Freudian slip there, are the great migration generation. We have one foot on analog soil and one foot on digital ground. We do remember a time before smartphones. We remember dial-up. We remember when being online was a specific deliberate activity, a destination you chose to travel to. The internet for us used to have an address, a physical location, in the sense that you sat down in a specific chair, a specific room, often the family computer room, and you signed on. You did a thing, you connected, and then you disconnected. You went back to the physical world. Because of this, most millennials have what I call the switch in our heads. We remember what it was like to be bored at a bus stop with nothing but your own thoughts. We remember uninterrupted meals. We remember genuinely not knowing things and just staying not knowing them, sometimes for days. And then AOL Instant Messenger arrived. That sound, wow, those of you who know, you know. The sound of the door opening or message ping meant someone in the world had typed words and those words traveled through a wire and arrived specifically for you. It was magic. Genuine revolutionary magic. Our mental model for the internet was, it's a collection of spaces, and you choose which spaces to inhabit. You had relative autonomy over your online experience. You went where you wanted. You visited the websites you sought out. And then Facebook introduced the algorithmic newsfeed in 2006. And the internet stopped being a collection of spaces you visited. It became a river that flowed past you. And that river was curated, visibly by a machine, to keep you standing there watching. And millennials, we got blindsided by the river. We didn't have a tool in our box for that. We thought we were choosing our online experience. We didn't realize the space was also choosing us, that it was studying us, learning us, engineering our emotional responses to keep us engaged. That is why millennials sometimes blame themselves or each other for what the algorithm surfaces. Why do you keep getting arguments online? Because the platform is literally designed to optimize for outrage. Our tool says the internet is a place you navigate. The reality is the algorithm is navigating you. The good news about millennials is that we've lived through enough change. We've watched the internet become something almost unrecognizable from what we first knew, that we're generally more flexible about updating our mental models. We're not quite digital natives, but we've been in digital information long enough to speak the language pretty fluently. We're also, by the way, the generation most likely to be providing tech support in both directions simultaneously. Explaining smartphones to our parents and explaining why you can't just download more storage to our kids with a tech support sandwich. It is exhausting and also a little funny. All right, we arrive at Gen Z, born roughly 1997 to 2012. Imagine if we have listeners in this generation, that's about as far as it goes back. Our youngest listeners would be in this generation. Their younger siblings, Gen Alpha, are still being born. Gen Z doesn't have the switch. The toolbox doesn't have an off button. Because the world has never been off. Connectivity isn't something you activate. It's a condition of existence, like air. Gen Z is the first generation of true digital natives. And I want to be precise about what that means because it's more radical than people often realize. Their first computers were often touchscreens. The first interface is designed to be intuitive through direct manipulation. You touch the thing and the thing responds. When your foundational mental model for human-computer interaction is I reach out and touch the thing and the thing moves, it does something profound for your relationship with technology. A mouse, that little plastic puck you move around on a flat surface to control a cursor, is from a Gen Z perspective bizarre and unnecessarily abstract middleman. Why would you move a thing over here to affect something over there? Why not just touch the thing? Touchscreens remove that layer of abstraction. The screen is the thing. There's no gap between interaction or intention and action. I gave my new Gen Alpha nephew a National Geographic magazine. I watched him try to swipe the page to make the picture move. When it didn't work, he looked at me and said, "Uncle Will, the paper's frozen." Paper's frozen. That's possibly the most succinct description of the generational gap I've ever heard from a six-year-old. To him, the magazine wasn't a magazine. It was a broken tablet. There's a famous story, well-circulated enough that it feels essentially true, of a toddler who found an old television, walked up to it and tried to swipe it. Nothing happened. They looked confused and then distressed. The television wasn't broken, but it didn't fit the framework. It was an object that looked like it should respond to touch, but didn't. A broken tablet. Now here's the flip side of the Gen Z toolbox. They are phenomenally fast at acquiring new interfaces. When you grow up assuming that any sufficiently designed surface should be intuitive and responsive, you approach new technology with a kind of fearless experimentation that older generations often lack. They just try things. They poke around. They assume they can figure it out by interacting with it. But Gen Z's challenge is the mirror image of boomers. Where boomers struggle with too little information, where do I find the thing? Gen Z grapples with overwhelming abundance. How do I know which thing to trust? Gen Z has grown up in an environment where a peer-reviewed scientific study and a teenager's hot take on TikTok have identical production values. They look the same. They arrive through the same channels. Their toolbox is extremely well-equipped for navigating interfaces, but still developing the tools for evaluating the provenance and credibility of information. It's not a character flaw. It's a toolbox gap, and it's one that's actively being worked on. One more Gen Z observation that I genuinely love. If you ask a 16-year-old where a file is saved on their laptop, they will look at you like you asked them to describe the color of Thursday. They don't use folders. They use search. The organizational paradigm is not place things in logical locations so you can find them later. The organizational paradigm is it exists somewhere and I will find it when I need it. This drives boomers and Gen Xers completely up the wall. But where is it? It's in my files. But which folder? I don't know. I'll search them all. Both approaches work. They're just different tools. So what actually happens when different toolboxes collide in the real world? We talk past each other, constantly. And the frustrating thing is that we usually can't even see why. Because we're each reasoning from our own framework, which feels from the inside like simply common sense. Let me give you three specific examples. Example one, the cloud. We've talked about these a little bit. For Boomer, the cloud is frightening. Their toolbox says important things must live somewhere specific in a physical, stable location. You don't put in important documents somewhere in the sky. That's not where things live. For a Gen Z kid, the cloud is just the default state of storage. Of course things are in the cloud. Why else wouldn't they be? Where else would they be? Neither person is wrong. They're just operating from a fundamentally different spatial metaphor. Example two, file management. Similar idea. Boomers and Gen Xers grew up with folders inside folders, direct mirrors of physical filing cabinets. Millennials learn to search, but still maintain some folder structure out of habit. Gen Z doesn't file at all. They search. Now imagine this. A boomer manager asks a Gen Z employee to go find this contract in the archives. The Gen Z employee walks into the records room, finds actual cardboard boxes, and spends 20 minutes looking for a search bar. They're not being difficult. They're not lazy. They literally do not have the alphabetical paper filing tool in their box. The tool is never installed. Example three, phone calls. If your telephone was for most of your formative life primarily a device for voice communication, then calling someone is the natural, obvious, low friction way to meet them, to reach them. Quick question. Call them. Need an answer? Call. If your phone is a handheld computer that also happens to make calls, receiving an unexpected voice call is genuinely jarring. It's an intrusion. A phone call in this framework is high bandwidth, time sensitive, demands immediate full attention, and provides no opportunity to formulate a thoughtful response. It's the communication equivalent of someone knocking on your office door without an appointment. Same device, completely different toolboxes. Enormous potential for mutual frustration. And here's the deepest, most uncomfortable part of all of this. We are all blind to the assumptions baked into our own framework. The water we swim in is invisible to us. We don't experience our mental models as models. We experience them as reality, as common sense, as just how things work. Seeing your own toolbox requires meta-awareness. It requires stepping outside your framework long enough to ask, is this how it actually works? Or is this just how my toolbox says it should work? Generational tech conflicts, almost without exception, are not about laziness. They're not about stubbornness. They're not about one generation being smarter or more adaptable than another. They are almost always about a toolbox mismatch. And once you can name that, it changes everything. So how do we actually fix this? How do we bridge the gap? How do we stop accidentally frustrating each other over reply all emails and broken magazines? I want to give you a set of principles I've come to think of as sort of a MacGyver mindset for conceptual toolboxes. Because here's the thing about MacGyver. Yes, he had a great literal toolbox, but his real superpower wasn't the tools. It was his curiosity, his willingness to look at what he had and ask, what can this do that I haven't tried yet? All right, that's the mindset we want to follow. Here's how to apply it. Principle one, acknowledge the toolbox. When someone is struggling with technology, whether it's your mom asking a dumb question or a colleague doing something that seems inexplicably backwards, resist the urge to correct them. Instead, recognize that they're asking a deeper question. How does this fit into the framework how does this fit into my framework for how the world works? Before you explain the answer, try to understand the question beneath the question. What framework are they operating from? What does this look like from inside their toolbox? Part two, build the translation layer. Find the right analogy, and crucially, use their analogy, not yours. When I help someone from the boomer generation understand cloud storage, I don't say upload to the cloud. I say, it's like a safety deposit box, but the bank is very reliable. It's accessible from anywhere, and you don't have to drive there to open it. That's their language. When I'm talking to a Gen Xer who wants to understand why their teenager doesn't use folders, remember when you switch from physically rewinding tapes to just pressing stop and not worrying about it? Same principle. System handles the organization, so you don't have to think about it. That resonates. When explaining to a millennial why their Gen Z intern suddenly seems to have no patience for email, remember when text messages first came out and suddenly calling someone for a quick question felt bizarrely formal and high commitment? That's how they feel about email now. Match the analogy to the toolbox. Principle three, separate the framework from the fact. The person isn't confused about facts. They're confused because the facts don't fit their framework. If you only address the fact, no, the file isn't lost, it's in the cloud, you haven't actually solved the problem. The next time they encounter the cloud, they'll be just as disoriented. But if you address the framework, explain why the cloud works differently, you've actually installed a new tool. Principle four, have some empathy for the blinders, because we're all wearing them. This is the most important one. Give yourself permission to not know things. Give others the same permission. I'm a millennial, although just barely. I still feel an irrational urge to press save every 5 minutes, even on Google Docs, which saves automatically and continuously. That's my baggage. That's my toolbox talking. It's not rational. I know it's not rational, and yet, here we go. We need to stop treating technological fluency like an IQ test, like some people are smart enough to get it and others aren't. It's not an intelligence issue. It's a framework issue. And frameworks can be updated with patience, good analogies, and a little bit of grace. Think of it as a language barrier, not a capability gap. Principle five, tell your own story of confusion. The most disarming thing you can do in helping someone with technology is to tell them about a time you were completely lost. Tell them about thinking that the modem was a tornado warning. Tell them about the first time you encountered a concept that made no sense in your existing framework. Tell them about the time you confidently did something completely wrong for months before someone gently corrected you. Your confusion story is a gift. It says, this is hard, and being confused by it doesn't mean anything is wrong with you. Principle six, remember, your turn is coming. Right now, somewhere in a lab, someone is developing augmented reality interfaces, brain-computer interfaces, spatial computing environments that will make our current concept of a screen seem as quaint as a rotary dial on a phone. And when that arrives, middle-aged millennials, my people, are going to be completely disoriented. Our toolbox will fail us. And some 25-year-old is going to look at us with barely concealed impatience and say, it's not that complicated. While we desperately try to find the thing that is in their world, just the air. We owe each other the grace of knowing this is not a permanent condition of any generation. It's a temporary condition of being human in a world that changes faster than our frameworks do. All right, let's bring this thing home. Eventually, people figure it out. Slowly and perfectly, with a lot of help and a lot of patience on both sides. But they figure it out. They build new tools. They expand their toolbox. They stay curious about a world that keeps changing around them. And that, I think, is the whole thing. This isn't really about technology. Technology is just the arena where this plays out most visibly. If this is about the posture you bring to the idea of not knowing, do you get defensive when your framework doesn't fit? Or do you get curious? Because here's the truth. Nobody has a complete toolbox. Nobody. The boomer who struggles with cloud storage is also a person who can read a paper map, navigate a bureaucracy, fix a mechanical thing with their hands. Skills that are quietly disappearing from the Gen Z toolkit. The Gen Z native who can navigate a new interface in 30 seconds is also a person who never had to sit with an unresolved question for 72 hours and develop patience and intellectual tolerance for not knowing. We all have gaps. We all have strengths that come from our particular era and experience. And we all, if we're honest, have moments where our toolbox fails us completely. MacGyver could build a helicopter out of a lawnmower and some bubblegum, but he'd probably struggle with TikTok's privacy settings. And that's okay. He'd figure it out eventually. That was always kind of the point for MacGyver. Not that he had all the tools, but that he refused to give up when he didn't. We owe each other that refusal. The willingness to say, my toolbox doesn't have what I need for this, but I'm going to figure it out. And your toolbox is different from mine, but that doesn't make it wrong. Communication across differences, generational differences, cultural differences, any kind of differences, starts with that recognition. All right, folks, that's our episode. Joshua will hopefully be back next time, hopefully rested, definitely wiser, and presumably having successfully explained to at least one retiree that the cloud is not a weather phenomenon, unless it is. Always check the forecast. And remember, keep your tools sharp, keep your heart open, keep your mind open. And the next time somebody looks at a modem like it might be announcing a tornado, sit down with them. Tell them what you hear when you listen to it. Ask them and tell you what they hear. You might be surprised what you learn. Take care of yourselves.